You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, November 24th, 2020, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hello, everyone.
We're recording a day early to give everybody a chance to get ready for Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm. Turkey Day.
Turkey Day, yep.
An isolated Thanksgiving, Steve.
Yeah, right? Isolated COVID pandemic Thanksgiving.
Yep. I tried to talk Steve into coming to my house. I caved. I'm like, come on, Steve. We know we don't have COVID. You know you don't have COVID. And Steve was like, Jay, this is exactly how people get COVID.
Yeah. Isn't like family get-togethers going to be the number one source of transmission?
Totally.
Right?
Well, it's going to be bubbles colliding with other bubbles.
Yeah. Yeah. So we talked about it. It's like the bottom line is we could like maybe do some, you know, social distancing and mask wearing. But the bottom line is with that many people in one space for even multiple hours eating, the bottom line is if one of us had COVID, everyone's going to get COVID. Like we would not keep that from happening.
It's a family style meal.
And Kara, Steve called it social distancing theater.
Yeah, basically would not have been enough. I couldn't have done it. And I'm coming off of 2 weeks inpatient, so it's I'm sort of pseudo quarantining, even though I didn't come into direct contact with any known COVID positive patients. You're still in a freaking hospital, you know.
Right.
In a way, I kind of understand what Jay is saying. It would feel unnatural to not at least extend the invitation to you, even though he knows it's a no. But if he...
We'll do a Zoom thing.
Yeah. But the whole Zoom thing, like, you know, we live in a world now where there's a lot more screen time, a lot more like face-to-face screen time. And no matter what version of it we do, you do it on the TV, you're sit close to your computer or whatever, like, you don't feel like you're with people with the screens. You really don't.
It's not as good. It's not as good, but it's better than nothing.
I think it depends on the context, right? Because I'm doing a lot of like teletherapy and I feel very present with the patients. But it's also when you're face-to-face talking about, you know, heavy stuff and you're really present for an hour with somebody, I think it's like you're there together. I think it's different when you're sort of just broadcasting your movements. You know, you're sort of walking around the house with a phone being like, so-and-so's cooking the turkey. Hey, babe, say hi. That, to me, you're right. It feels a bit weird and remote.
Well, also, you know, when you're one-on-one and you're focusing, you're getting, you can hear everything. You know, when you get like multiple people, it's pandemonium.
It's pandemic pandemonium.
Yeah, it just doesn't, you can't, it's not clear. It just, you know, you just, everything gets so muddy and you're just like, oh my God. Like, you just want to, I want to get out of those situations. I'm very uncomfortable.
You know, I'm also interested, Jay, you brought up this term that you said Steve used, the, what was it, social distancing theater. But this idea of hygiene theater that I hear people reference a lot that I think is an interesting psychological concept. And I'd love to hear you guys' takes on this. You know, we know that COVID can pass from surfaces, that there is a fomite transmission, but we also know that that's significantly lower than aerosol
droplets
transmission.
In the air.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Than breathing in the same space as somebody who has the virus, because it's an airborne respiratory virus, among other things. And I'm always interested when I go to a place, they're going to great distances to like wipe surfaces and to, you know, use all these cleansers and draw attention to the fact that they're scrubbing so hard, yet people are walking around without masks.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, what? Is it just that psychologically we need to be doing something? And so seeing a Lysol wipe really helps us feel safe?
Because I think weirdly what I've experienced, I've experienced this with every permutation you could think of, is that if people think if they're doing one thing, then they're good. It's like, I'm wearing a mask, so I don't have to be as careful about socially distancing. Or we're outside, so we could take our masks off. Or you were wiping down all the surfaces, so whatever. It's like, no, they don't get that. You have to do everything because each of these interventions is preventing you getting COVID in a different way, and one does not obviate the need for another. You still have to socially distance if you're outside, you know?
And half measures don't get you halfway there.
No,
it's
you're
zero
right.
There.
Yeah.
It's a very contagious virus. You could do everything you're supposed to do and still get it. And if you're not doing everything you're supposed to doing, you're supposed to do, you're just playing Russian roulette. If you if you get exposed to the virus, you're probably going to get it.
Right. And we know this because we see, I mean, we know this anyway, but we see frontline workers getting it left and right. You know, one of the people I work with at the hospital got it. And the thing is, there's no way to know where she got it or how. But for people who are trained in proper hygiene and who are so careful and who are not working in a COVID ward, to still get it means that it is that contagious.
Yes, but to be clear, Kara, like at Yale, we have gotten the the rate of hospital staff catching it down to almost nothing because
that's great.
Because we know what we're doing now. You know what I mean?
Like, and I think it's really similar where I'm working too. I mean, and that's why it's also almost impossible to know where you got it. Was it community transmission? Did you pick it up at the grocery store? You know, the one time
I think
you went
I'm more likely to get it at the grocery store than working in the hospital, to be honest.
I feel safer. You're right. I feel safer at the hospital than in the grocery store, too. And I'm working, you know, in an outpatient clinic. These are people who are not, you know, doing the same kind of screening as somebody who's admitted. Obviously, there's screens.
Quick update. So the worldwide, we're at 60 million cases, 1.4 million deaths. In the U.S., where we were breaking all kinds of records, almost hit 200,000 cases in a single day. This wave is bigger than the previous two. You know, at least 12,500,000 cases have been recorded since February 29th in the U.S. So it's still raging. This is, you know, this is actually probably the most dangerous time right now. You know, people are acting like we're at the other side of this, but we're actually at the worst point of it right now, and we don't even know if this is going to be the worst wave we're going to get.
But it's the worst so far. And the worst so far is happening when everybody is so fatigued by this.
And the holidays are hitting and it's bad. However, you know, 2 weeks ago, Pfizer announced their vaccine. 1 week ago, Moderna announced their vaccine. This week, we have AstraZeneca and Oxford University announcing their vaccine. So we have a third vaccine in as many weeks. So this is not an mRNA vaccine like the other two. This is a weakened virus. What they did is they took an adenovirus, a regular cold virus. They modified it in two ways. One way so that it expresses the spike proteins of the SARS-CoV-2, and that's to provoke an immune reaction against, you know, the COVID virus. Mm-hmm. And they also made it so it can't replicate, so it's weakened, you know, so you can't get sick from it. But it is an actual virus. It's not a killed virus. It's a weakened virus. The data is, again, the same thing, phase three trial, preliminary data, but it looks good. So they're reporting 70% efficacy for the whole trial, right? Which is not as good as the 95% of the
But still two. Decent, though, right?
Still decent. Still decent. Just not as good. But they said, however, we got our efficacy up to 90%. So you have to dig in a little bit and see what that means.
Yeah.
They did a small
dosage change.
Yeah, so the most of the people who got the vaccine got two full doses. You know, it's two, like the other two, it's two vaccines. So all three vaccines require two doses. But they did a small subgroup where they did a half dose for the first treatment followed by a full dose for the second. And that group got 90% efficacy.
Interesting.
The two full doses got 62% efficacy. They average out the numbers to 70% overall. But, you know, I got to be honest with you, I just don't find that compelling. I think that's probably just a quirk of the data, and it's probably not going to hold up. But I could be wrong. But now it's more of a hypothesis than a conclusion, right? They wanted to look at the doses to see if they could see a dose effect, but it's kind of going the wrong way. Like, you would expect the full dose would have more of an effect than the half dose. But they said maybe there's a sweet spot in terms of, and the immune system can be that way, kind of react to a sweet spot. But
that's what the phase three trial is really supposed to be about, right? Like, this sounds like it's not ready.
Well, the thing is, at the very least, you know, it's going to have that 60 to 70% efficacy, and that's enough. And so now what they're going to do is expand the low dose arm to see if that 90% efficacy holds up for some weird reason. And if it does, then that will be the dose that they'll give, and maybe they'll be able to claim 90% efficacy. So that's still an unknown, I would say, at this point, because it was just sort of a surprise finding in a smaller subgroup and not the full trial. So
don't forget the big advantage, though, Steve.
I'm not forgetting. I'm getting there. So this vaccine can be stored at refrigerator temperatures for 6 months. So
there you go.
Yeah.
You don't have to freeze it. So this will be very easy to distribute, easier than the other two. Again, it's not a deal killer for the other two.
You never have to freeze it.
Yeah, just refrigerate it for 6 months. So that's, anyone in their office can keep it.
Is that because it's not an mRNA?
Yeah, I think so. It's just a different kind of vaccine. And the other thing is they also are projecting they'll be able to crank out 3 billion doses by the end of 2021.
Oh, my God. That is awesome.
Great. Vaccinate half the planet. Wonderful.
Yeah. Well, remember, it's 2 doses per person, so it's 1.5 billion.
That's a lot. You combine that with the Moderna.
Yeah, with like 600 million from Pfizer, 500 million from Moderna. We're getting there. You know, that's getting us to like half the planet between those three vaccines by the end of 2021. And of course, China has their vaccine. You know, Russia has their vaccines. Other vaccines will be coming out. We'll get the world vaccinated by the end of 2021. At the very least, we'll have enough doses to theoretically vaccinate the world, probably by the end of 2021. However,
compliance.
There's an issue of vaccine refusal. So there was a recent survey where they asked adults 50 to 80 years old, if the COVID-19 vaccine was available now and it was free, would you definitely take it, somewhat likely to take it, somewhat unlikely to take it, very unlikely, or you don't know? Only 58% of people said they were either very or somewhat likely to take it. And 39% said they were, and 28% said they were either somewhat or very unlikely to take it. 14% said they were unsure.
I hope they also asked why they felt that way. Because I think that's important. You'd have to, because we need to crush certain misconceptions out there about this.
Yeah. So definitely. It was more hesitancy among women than men, more hesitancy among minorities than among whites. To that question, though, Evan, about half of the people surveyed also said that they'd like to wait until other people get it first. So
right.
That suggests
that's
they're
exactly
concerned
what I was
about
thinking.
The safety.
Was that in America or was it worldwide? Yeah, sorry. America. It was just in America. I get it.
That makes sense.
It's
a brand new vaccine. This process created a vaccine faster than ever before. And sure, I wouldn't mind waiting to see, if people turn into supervillains.
Well, no, it's not. I mean, I think beyond that, really, it's that ultimately it was politicized.
Yeah.
And I
trust.
Think that stuck in a lot of people's minds. Was this done safely? Was it done, slowly enough?
Was it rushed?
Is the regulation there? Was this all some sort of a political move for, candidate gain? And that's why I'm wondering what the numbers would look like in the U.S. compared to in other countries.
Yeah, we'll see. I think we'll also have to, this is going to be a moving target. We'll see where the numbers are in a month. But it is funny, I understand what you're saying, Bob. Yeah, and there's reason to be a little bit concerned. But you are basically saying experiment on my neighbors first before I make it.
Yeah,
there's no way around that.
Exactly.
There's no way around that.
Right.
Yeah. And was I a little obscure? That's exactly what I'm saying.
No, I'm just pointing that out. I'm just putting a little bit of a finer point on that.
Well, when people ask me about would you ever go to space, it's like I wouldn't be the first non-astronaut to go to space. Make sure, a bunch of people have done it first. I think that's a very human response. But that also shows that there's a bit of safety and security in your daily life. Like, I don't mind waiting a little longer, as opposed to, a lot of frontline workers, a lot of people who are out there working in grocery stores, working in hospitality, being like, no, I want to get this vaccine because I'm at risk every day.
You're absolutely right. If I was on the front line, I'd be jumping.
Well, here's the other thing. What you're basically saying is you have to do an individual risk versus benefit analysis. And given that we're in the middle of a pandemic, anyone can get this pandemic. Anyone can get sick from it. Anyone can die from it. Yes, your chances are a lot greater if you have chronic conditions, underlying conditions and comorbidities, et cetera. But given all of that, and given the data that we have, 40,000 in one trial, 30,000 in another trial, et cetera, with no major side effects yet, statistically speaking, you're probably a lot more likely to benefit from the vaccine than to get harmed by it, even if you're the first one in line after the trial,
True.
So
that's true.
And in fact, if you wait and you get sick in the interim, that's probably a greater risk to you than the risk you're avoiding by waiting. You know what I mean? You have to do that calculation. But people are risk averse. And so you make that I'll wait and avoid the risk of the vaccine. But actually, the risk of waiting may be greater to you than the risk you're avoiding by waiting. And so as an individual, it still is the right thing. Even if you're selfish and you're making just the best decision for you personally and not the community, it's still better to get vaccinated that even early on than to wait. Mm-hmm. When you're, especially when you're in the middle of a pandemic, that's kind of the whole point. But
right.
The great news is that, you know, with three plus vaccines now ready to go. I mean, the FDA hasn't given the emergency use authorization yet, but they might. They might by the time this podcast comes out.
Right.
When those EUAs go out, you know, they're going to start cranking out doses. They're going to start mobilizing them, getting them out there. This is our road to normality. This is the way we're going to get out of this pandemic, you know?
So this is three really good vaccines in as many weeks or so.
Yeah.
In 3 months, how many more will we have in the queue?
Well, I think worldwide there may be another dozen or so. You know, I think these are the big ones. You know, for the U.S.
And then I'm interested in how things are going to settle out or shake out once a massive vaccination sort of campaign is complete, based on non-compliance, based on refusal, based on the different reservoirs. I'm interested to see, is this going to be seasonal? Is it going to be something that keeps popping up? Or are we going to be able to wipe out enough of it that we would need almost like another spillover event for it to become
Will it be endemic or will this shut it down totally?
Exactly.
Yeah, right. We'll have to wait and see. And that will depend on what it will take to get to herd immunity and will we get there?
Yeah.
How about this? How about proof of vaccination? Show me your proof of vaccination. That just occurred to me. Imagine if that really became a thing. It's not. But imagine if that became a thing, like you get a tattoo on your forehead.
I got vaccinated. It might not be public, like you have to wear it like a sticker, but it could be you need to do it to do certain things, like go to school or your job, you know, whatever.
So how could you prove it?
I mean, you'd have records.
You'd have to be issued a card.
Yeah, you have a yellow card. Just like, I mean, you already have to have that to travel to certain countries. You have to have your yellow fever vaccine, or you have to, like,
yeah, to
you
get
know,
on
like
a plane
Lisa, to get into school. I'm not in that much disbelief that there will be a zoonotic infection in the future that will require exactly what you're talking about, Bob. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's that far-fetched to think that there may be something that's so incredibly deadly, that's so scary, like it in, you know, the movies that we've seen.
Yeah.
Where you got to get vaccinated and you wear the, you know, symbol, or you have some sort of barcode or something. You know, we think of that as being some dystopian future, but I can totally see it. There's a realistic risk there.
So the bottom line is, whoever was playing this massive game of Plague Inc., they lost because we made the vaccine first, so we win.
Uh-huh.
All right. Let's move on to some news items. Kara, this is a quirky one. This is about the popularity of the Principia by Isaac Newton. Tell us about
this. Okay, so do you guys remember when we visited the Cambridge Library?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yes, I do. I was looking at pictures the other day.
And there were beautiful books throughout the library. Oh, and if you've never been to the Cambridge Library, they're in these kind of book displays, these glass displays. I can't remember if they're like laid out, was it on like red velvet or red felt? And then they have cloth coverings so that in between viewings you can block the light from these books.
UV is damaging.
Yeah. And they run the gamut, right? There's an original Principia there. There are even older books from like the 1400s, I think I remember, that are, you know, hand calligraphied and gilded. It was just amazing to see.
That, to me, that place was like, was sacred.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? I am not religious at all. That was sacred to me. And if we talk about, you know, instilling like agency into objects, that's as much agency as I could imbue into an object. These things are just like...
Absolutely. And so, you know, we saw Principia. It's called Principia for short. It's actually the Philosophiae Naturalis Principia Mathematica, which translates to Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy. It was first published in 1687. It's actually a series of three. There were two more editions that were put out after that with some edits, some changes. And of course, within the Principia, we saw a lot of important groundbreaking and really what we think of as like foundational classical mechanics. We saw laws of motion, universal gravitation, and these really were, you know, transformative in the sense that they laid the groundwork. It's sort of the basis of how we thought and think to some extent still today about objects in motion, about planetary bodies, up until the theory of relativity, right? And then we had to start iterating. There's also some interesting mathematical descriptions within it. Now, we do know that Newton co-developed. I don't think that's the right way to put it, because he and Leibniz were like enemies, but they each developed calculus. But actually, calculus, at least in the original, was not well established. There were more like geometric usages of mathematics. He also contributed, as we know, to optics, and he's sort of what we think of as one of the most influential Enlightenment scientists, Enlightenment thinkers, really ushering in the sort of scientific era. Now, the book itself historically was thought to have not been that popular. So there was a publication in the 1950s where individuals searched for copies of the book and only found 189 copies of the first edition. And so in looking at those copies, where were they? Who were they in the hands of? What was their kind of quality? It was determined that probably this book was not widely printed. It was likely really hard to read. I mean, not likely. It is really hard to read. And a lot of people thought, okay, this is a book that sort of only experts in the field could understand. And even experts in the field were like, this is super esoteric. You know, like we think of string theory today. But there's actually a new publication that came out in the Annals of Science, just published by Mordecai Feingold from Caltech, who's like a science historian, and Andrei Svornichik, I think. And they were able to track down to do a new census of first editions of Newton's Principia. So again, published in 1687. And they found a grand total of 386 copies. So almost double what was originally thought. Yeah. And so based on their new census, they wrote a tome. I was like, oh, I'm going to read the original paper. And then I opened it and I was like, okay, wait, it's a 97-page publication in the Annals of Science, where they talked all about, you know, they cataloged every individual book. They looked at where is it housed, how long has it been housed there, who is in possession. But they also looked, I love this part, at the annotations within the book. And that showed them that not only was the Principia in the hands of other esteemed physicists or philosophers of the time, but also in the hands of educated lay people. And that was, I think, what really opened this up for them and said, hey, I know it's always been lore that this book was incomprehensible. There's even a story about a student walking across the Cambridge lawn saying, when Newton passed by, saying, there goes the man that writ a book that neither he nor anybody else understands. But ultimately, it does turn out that this very highly technical book, which, you know, introduced game-changing physics, like the universal law of gravitation, was more popular than we think. And even educated lay people were reading it, were annotating within it.
Wow.
And yeah, I mean, just such a cool little piece of science history that helps us understand the process of how we know what we knew. How we know what we know, which I think is so important. We often think of science as being really static. Oh, this thing happened, that thing happened. And we look at it through this massive hindsight bias. And that's why I think the history of science is such a fascinating field.
Yeah.
Because it's always more complicated than we want to believe.
Oh my God, yeah. Did they find any fakes, Kara?
No, they don't reference any of those things within their 97-page tome. So, but it may be that they weren't looking for them. That would be interesting, though, because you can imagine these are probably so expensive for collectors.
Right?
Oh,
right?
Sure.
I wonder
of course they
how
are.
Much. I'd like to get a number just to see where it is.
I also think that it's probably not a terribly easy thing to forge.
Yeah, you'd have to replicate.
You'd have to get the glue, and you'd have to get the, you know, the print.
Sure.
The ink.
This
and,
is centuries old.
Mm-hmm.
Kara, did they take a picture? Like, do they have a digital record of this entire book?
You mean in this article?
No,
like, I bet you there. Oh,
I would just assume that they backed up everything in there.
Yeah, I bet you can find the full Principia online. I don't know if you'd be able to read it. I mean, it's not only is it difficult, you know, mathematically, but it's also difficult in terms of like the old English that it was written in. So at least it is in English, right. But it's, you know, that kind of English where the words don't flow very easily. And we have scholars that read Shakespeare and, you know, these different literary works. But imagine that superimposed on top of like highly technical mathematical language using, at the time, ways of thinking that were completely novel. I just looked, Bob, and it looks like a copy of Principia sold for $3.7
million
in 2016.
Right, okay.
So yeah, this is obviously something that like you'd have to be a pretty hardcore collector to have a copy of Principia in your library. And of course, I think one of the coolest things about this is the provenance, right? It's that there are detailed records. When you have a copy like this in a library or in a museum, and hopefully even with individual collectors who really care about this, there's a detailed record of the provenance. So we know who originally had it, where did it go after that? What are the annotations within it? And that was another cool thing. Do you guys remember when we were at Cambridge, weren't we looking at, it was like a copy of Huxley? And it had, was it Huxley with Darwin's notes in it?
No, it wasn't Huxley. Oh, okay. It was a first edition of On the Origin of Species, but it was owned by Darwin's intellectual enemy who wrote in the margins all the reasons why Darwin was wrong.
And they were all full of, and he was full of crap, everything he said, right?
Oh my gosh. So like that kind of stuff is so much more interesting than just the original.
Yeah,
right?
I totally agree.
Oh, I love this.
And in fact, I'll be talking a little bit later on my part, later in the show, putting Isaac Newton's impact into a little bit of further context.
Ooh.
We'll get to that a little bit later. First, Jay, you're going to tell us about supersized wind turbines.
So 20 years ago, wind and solar were barely making a dent in the overall, you know, collection of renewable energy. So, but in the year 2000, solar was generating 1.12 terawatt hours and wind was generating 31.4 terawatt hours. So at that time in the year 2000, wind was generating less than 1% of the total electricity needed for the United States. Now, let's zoom forward to 2019. Solar is generating 724 terawatt hours and wind is generating 1,429 terawatt hours.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So you could see, you know, there's a significant increase in the amount of energy that wind is creating. But, you know, it's not changing the world yet. There's still a long way to go. And scientists realize that. So today, wind is producing the same amount of electricity that hydro was producing back in 1975. Just to give you a little bit more of a perspective, hydro is by far where we get the most bang for the buck when it comes to renewable energy. So in 2019, wind produced 7% of the electricity needs in the United States. People who are critical of renewable energy, and there's a lot of them out there, they say that it's hard to rely on it because why? Because the power that you collect varies, right? You can't rely on it. It's not like a coal-fired plant. You turn it on, and after a certain number of hours, it's going to generate a steady stream of electricity. Renewables don't work that way. But some experts are saying that there are ways to overcome that limitation. And I think that this is really interesting because it really does seem to mitigate the problem. So in 2017, the U.S. Department of Energy's National Renewable Energy Laboratory, the NREL, invited 70 experts from around the world to review the current science of renewable energy. The result of the meeting came out in 2019 when their findings were published along with technological goals in order for wind to supply up to 50% of the world's power. Jonathan Naughton, who is an engineer at the University of Wyoming, said that wind is really an atmospheric fluid mechanics problem, and he went on to say that they need more information about how wind behaves at the altitudes the turbines function in. So the experts determined that bigger and taller wind turbines are needed. Now, I know that sounds kind of funny because you're like, yeah, just make them bigger, you know, but there's so much complexity, right? You don't just make something bigger. Let's just build a bigger dump truck. It doesn't work that way. If they made them bigger, the upsides would be then fewer turbines would be needed, which would lower the overall cost to buy and maintain them. And also, if the turbines were higher above the ground, they could collect more power because of the increased wind speeds found there. Air is actually viscous, meaning it sticks together, and when air is close to the ground, it moves slower because of friction, just like the sides of a river do, right? You know, in the middle, it's the fastest, and it kind of gets slower as you go to the sides. So higher altitude means higher winds, which means higher wind speeds, which means more energy. And it's pretty easy to understand that we'd want the wind turbines up higher, so there's more consistent air being blown around.
Yeah, that's another factor, Jay, is the consistency at the higher altitude, because every wind turbine has a minimum speed at which they will generate electricity. So they basically turn off if the velocity of the wind drops below that minimum amount. But if you're like in the stream, you know, if you're at an altitude where there's a more of a continuous wind, it's more consistent.
Yeah, and I wondered, because I've seen tons of wind turbines throughout my travels, and it's weird to see like this one's on and like these 10 are off. What's going on? I always wondered, like, what are they down for
maintenance? Yeah, me too.
Yeah, it really is. Like the wind is just happens to be blowing a little bit faster. And
it's above threshold.
Yeah, and it clicks on. It knows how fast the wind is blowing, and they turn it on. So today's scientists understand how the atmosphere works on a very large scale. You know, they can track hurricanes and look at weather on that scale. And they also can understand weather on a small scale. But there is like this middle gap that they say that they don't fully comprehend the complexity of it yet. So the scientists also have to learn more about how giant wind turbines would function structurally, because higher winds means the materials would have to evolve to match the new environment that they're in. The blades have to be able to handle the, you know, different types of bending and twisting of the much more turbulent winds, also known as Reynolds numbers, which you should look up, by the way, because that was an interesting read. So they're using computer modeling to help them work out the physics of today's best computers that simulate physics. And finally, they need to also work out how groups of turbines will interact with each other, because they all create atmospheric wakes. So when the air passes through a typical wind turbine that you've seen today, it changes the shape and the spin of the wind, and it's called a wake, of course, like, you know, kind of like when you see an airplane fly by and you see like those spirals come off the wings. So these wakes can pile up and make bigger disturbances, and possibly and typically do affect other wind turbines around them, and it also can affect people and farms downwind. You know, they're being very, very, very careful about, you know, what would the potential outcome be if they built these gigantic wind turbines. The scientists who develop wind turbine technology also know that as they scale up in size, the complexity significantly increases. It's not one to one. They get, you know, more and more and more profoundly complicated as they go bigger. But the good news is wind turbine size has already begun to increase. So back in the 1990s, wind turbines commonly had rotor diameters around 30 meters. And today that number has increased past 100 meters. So, you know, they're doing it. They're slowly iterating these versions up to make them bigger. But I don't believe that they've actually significantly increased the height of the wind turbines. And that's really what we're talking about here. We're not just talking about the size of the blades, which are the diameters. We're talking about the actual height of those blades themselves. So as the size increases, the amount of power that can be collected increases, because with more airflow means that the turbine can be moved faster. And if you have bigger blades, it's actually creating more energy because the blades are bigger, right? It's like the outside of a record is spinning faster than the inside of a record. And now the turbine blades translates into bigger blades means more aerodynamic efficiency as well. So as you can see, there's lots of things that are going on in here. And I did read one fact I thought was very interesting. They've discovered that 4 blades work better than 3 blades because they create less wind turbulence.
Oh, yeah?
So, yeah, I think we're going to be seeing 4-bladed wind turbines. And for some reason, this is just me, the 3-bladed wind turbines always seemed a little weird to me. I kind of wanted them to, I don't know, I just wanted them
kinda
to have 4
like
blades.
Because
you want it to look like, you know, like one of the ones in Holland.
Yeah, exactly.
Like what we think
that's
of as a classic.
Oh. Yeah, I just want it balanced more.
Among the tulip fields.
Yeah, and you're right, Steve, they look like propellers. They look like the fronts of giant planes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they also said like the bigger ones could potentially make a lot more noise. So they're using hints from nature to help mitigate the noise that's created. You know, like owl feathers, as an example, have some really unbelievably cool structures in them to silence the air. You know, they fly almost silently. If you've ever seen or heard a video of an owl flying. So, you know, this is really cool, but, you know, the technology is doing better. And the next 20 years, they're saying that they can have dramatic increases.
Yeah, it's like we talk a lot about solar and battery, but wind turbine technology is also incrementally improving and improving. The electronics on the inside, the aerodynamics on the outside, and it can, you know, get to the point where it produces a tremendous percentage of our energy. The other advantage over solar is like solar, it's like it's only obviously on when the sun is up. But the wind, it doesn't blow all the time, but it can blow all the time. You know what I mean?
Yep.
And so if you have a big enough grid, the wind's always blowing somewhere. The wind, the sun isn't always shining somewhere
right.
If you're looking at a small part of the world. Obviously, if you talk about the whole world, then it obviously is. But if you're looking at like just the United States, for example, or just Australia or whatever, you know, yeah, at some point of the day, the entire country's in night, but the wind is still blowing somewhere. Bob, so this is a fascinating item about forming a magnetic star from the collision of other stars, or at least stellar corpses.
Yeah, I love this news item. Data from the Hubble telescope suggests that the neutron star merger detected earlier this year did not form a black hole as expected, but created a magnetar, a class of stellar corpse that's among the most intensely magnetic objects in the known universe. And wow, where do I start with this one? There were so many ways to approach this. So let's start with the coolest word in my introduction, magnetar. Say it with me, magnetar.
Magnetar.
Wait, I didn't mean to bring pirates into this. A magnetar is a neutron star with an immensely powerful magnetic field. Typically, a star far heavier than the sun explodes in a supernova, leaving a remnant neutron star, right? That's pretty much where they come from. Think of, for a neutron star, think of something as big as Chicago, but each tablespoon of it weighing about as much as Mount Everest. That's a neutron star. And very few of these neutron stars have intense magnetic fields, many hundreds of thousands of times more intense than our suns. For example, if you were to get within a half moon distance to a magnetar, an intense magnetar, it would look like this harmless little dot, but your credit cards would suddenly be erased at half the moon distance. And if you got to 2,000 miles away, 2,000, right? That's a lot, 3,000 kilometers. The magnetar would still appear as like a pinpoint. It wouldn't look like anything special if you even noticed it, but its magnetism would pull every atom in your body into these long, weird needle shapes from 2,000 miles away. This is intense.
Sounds painful.
Yes. The new bit here, though, is that the recently discovered neutron star merger called the kilonova, which we've talked about, seems to have created a magnetar instead of a supernova, creating it. So this is the first time that's been detected. And the clue to this, though, was fascinating. The Hubble Space Telescope looked at the remains of the magnetar, and they saw something odd. You would think, you know, you would see, you know, what you could see, you know, the gravitational effects of a black hole or an accretion disk or whatever. But what they saw was an infrared light that was an order of magnitude brighter than it should have been. And if any of you were playing drinking games waiting for us to say order of magnitude, drink up. This is weird because if these colliding neutron stars produced a black hole as they should, there should not have been enough energy left over in the immediate environment to make it glow in the infrared like that. So that was like a big like, whoa, what's going on here? There should not be this much infrared if there was a black hole. So what is there? It could be this magnetar. So here's why a magnetar could follow this evidence, though, as described by study co-author Tan Moy Lascar. He said, you basically have these magnetic field lines that are anchored to the star that are whipping around about 1,000 times a second, and this produces a magnetized wind. These spinning field lines extract the rotational energy of the neutron star formed in the merger and deposit that energy into the ejecta from the blast, causing the material to glow even brighter. So a magnetar makes perfect sense. So I was trying to think of an analogy here, so this is what I got. This would be like if I stuck 1,000 straws deep inside Jay and spun him around, throwing his blood everywhere nearby. Okay, stay with me here. Stay with me. The magnetic field lines are the straws, and the blood is the rotational energy that's bleeding away. So I have to apologize at this point. I've been watching way too much Vampire Diaries with my mom. Oh, my God.
Bob, that's about the nerdiest thing you've ever said. But
yep.
Go ahead.
Oh, come on. I've done.
That's a high bar, Steve.
I've seen that. But so over time, say perhaps 10,000 years, that loss of rotational energy then will slow down the spin of the magnetar and the magnetism would dissipate. In the meantime, however, we can still see amazing things even after the merger happens. The merger isn't necessarily the big event. It's generally pretty big, but you can also have other things that happen afterwards. For example, it's believed that the mysterious fast radio burst that we've talked about on the show a bunch They believe common wisdom is now is that it's caused by extragalactic magnetars. But we're talking about over-the-top magnetism here, like greater than 10 to the 14 Gauss field. And that does some freaky stuff. Like I mentioned above, it can squeeze electron orbitals into a cigar shape. So a hydrogen atom would become 200 times narrower in such a field. And there's other bizarre effects that happen when the field is that intense. So on a magnetar, the spinning magnetic fields actually deform and break the super dense crust, right? Now, talk about dense crust. A neutron star has got some dense crust, and these spinning magnetic fields can actually break that apart. And that causes starquakes. Have you heard of starquake? Think of an earthquake.
No.
Think of an earthquake, but give it a magnitude of a frickin' 32. 32. And remember that this is logarithmic. So magnitude 9 is 10 times more powerful than 8, and 11 is 10 times more than 10, and so on, and go up to 32. That is some intense, intense energy. So much energy. It's so intense that it actually creates electrons and antimatter positrons out of basically pulling them out of the fabric of space, which then recombines and generates deadly gamma rays that speed through space. This is intense. We have seen effects from magnetars from 50,000 light years away on the opposite side of the core of our galaxy. We have seen effects that have actually changed our ionosphere. Think about it. The only thing in deep, deep space like that that could impact the Earth is a magnetar. This is how amazing they are. It actually changed our ionosphere a little bit in a detectable way from 50,000 light years away. And this was, you know, granted, this was probably the most intense starquake we've ever identified. But they are just amazing, amazing objects. I've got newfound respect for these buggers. So in the future, scientists will definitely be keeping their eyes trained on this area of space for sure. Because, I mean, we're not 100% sure it's a magnetar. So that within a few years, the material that was ejected from the burst could start to appear in radio wavelengths, and that would kind of be one of the things they'd be looking for to confirm that this is a magnetar.
Do magnetars die out? Do they run out of fuel?
Well, yeah. Well, like I said, because the rotational.
Well, I get that, but yeah, thank you.
Well, because of the rotational energy is being sucked away by the rotating field lines, and yeah, it'll slow down, and the magnetic fields will die out. So it'll become like a regular neutron star at some point. But then, of course, it'll evaporate in the heat death of the universe as well. But that's very far in the future. Paper co-author Gillian Rastenjad said that now that we have one very bright candidate kilonova, I'm excited for the new surprises that short gamma ray bursts and neutron star mergers have in store for us in the future. So,
hopefully indirectly.
Yeah, yes. So we'll be looking for more kilonovas. And now a kilonova could be a neutron-neutron star merger or a neutron star black hole merger. That's kilonova. And they also, don't forget, they create a good chunk of the heavy elements, gold, uranium, that life and our world needs, things that are very important. These are created in these kilonova collisions and explosions. So these are very, very important. So they're just endlessly fascinating. And hopefully we'll have many more kilonova detections in the future, distant ones and nearby ones that we can detect by the gravitational waves. Don't forget about them. That's another way to detect ones that are at a certain distance. So just endlessly fascinating stuff.
All right, Evan, we're going to really change gears here, come back down to Earth, and you're going to tell... This is a weird one. I'm not even sure what to make of this, about plant personality.
What?
Well, I found... Yeah, I found this at Bloomberg.com. The writer's name is Zoe Schlanger, and the article is titled, "The Botanist Daring to Ask, What If Plants Have Personalities?" So I'll talk about the article. So I'll talk about the article a little bit, and then maybe we can have a conversation, an open conversation about this. The article focuses on the work of Rick Carban. He's a professor at the University of California, Davis, and he's considered one of the foremost researchers of plant signaling and communication. Professor Carban has found that plants produce and respond to complex chemical signals. Well, I thought we knew that already. They can detect the slightest touch. They know when they're shaded by a cloud or a fellow plant and whether that plant is related to them. Several species can recognize their genetic kin and rearrange their bodies to avoid competing with siblings. They can manipulate predators to do their bidding and transmit electrical signals among their roots. One paper even suggests that some may perform arithmetic division to keep from starving at night when they can't perform photosynthesis. Interesting. Here's a quote from the professor. Animals and plants face similar kinds of selective pressures. Things want to eat them. They need to find food. They need to find mates. If we know more about animals and animals have solved a problem in a particular way, then it's not unreasonable to ask, I wonder if plants have done something analogous. Well, so when it comes to how a botanist might define the personality of a plant, Professor Carbon suggests that a plant such as a sagebrush, which is his specialty, one of the specialty plants that he's been studying for a very long time, sagebrush is finely attuned to variations in their distress response, and he considers that a metric of the personality of a plant. Mm-hmm. He says that he's a big fan of using what decades of psychology has learned, their methods, and asking if they apply to plants.
No, they don't.
Well, wait a minute.
But you can ask the question.
Hear him out fully, and then we can comment.
I did.
So in his search, in his search for behavioral patterns in plant life, he claims that he's found a compelling method, Steve. The method separates behavior into two processes. The first is judgment, and the second is decision-making, which is weighing the cost and benefits of different actions you might take and then taking an action. He said this applies perfectly well to plants. How different plants might weigh the threat of a predator and then take action against that threat could be considered a plant personality trait. Sometimes a plant can make themselves chemically unattractive, or plants can chemically summon predators that will eat whatever is eating them. So that's the gist of the article. And as soon as I read the headline, I started to think about all the times that I have heard about or read articles about the ascribing human characteristics to plants, yeah. Right? Do plants have feelings? Do they have intelligence? Can they react to music? If so, what kinds of music? Do plants like being talked to? And this is things that I've read about and heard about for literally decades. We have these very human-centric types of questions. We're trying to apply them to plants. And we want to be able to sort of express it in terms of our own feelings, our own human feelings and thoughts and ideas. Whereas maybe a better approach would be to ask questions like, for example, in what ways do plants make use of their chemistry to react to their natural surroundings? Or how do they react to external stimuli? Or what occurs in plants when they adapt to a changing environment? But when you start putting the context into questions about plant intelligence or emotions, you're invoking presumptions, which are probably unfair, really, to make.
Yeah, I think at best, being generous, it's a metaphor. And we use a lot of metaphors in science, and that's okay, but there's always the risk that you could take it too far.
And sure.
And so I'm unwilling to say that the scientist is taking it too far, because my sense was that this was honestly horrible science reporting that was like doubling and tripling down on a very dubious narrative and may not have been doing justice to the research itself or what the scientist says. But in any wherever it's coming from, in any case, it's like, yeah, plants react to the environment. They have evolved strategies of adaptive responses and different, and there's variability in those adaptive responses. You want to call that variability a personality? All right, that's
bananas. The word personality is personality.
Right.
It's not even about animals. It's about human experiences.
Well, I mean, I think if you say, like, does my dog have a personality? I would say, yeah, okay, sure. You could make,
But scientifically, could you say that?
Well, I wouldn't give them a human personality. But I think they have their own doggy personalities.
But right. It's just that, even the science, the psychology
a better metaphor.
Of personality.
Don't you say
it's a good
that.
Metaphor. You're right. But the psychology of personality is, like, difficult as it is, categorizing personalities.
That's where I completely agree. Like, then saying, can we learn from psychiatrists or psychologists? No, you can't, because they're not studying plants.
Yeah, and especially not in that respect. We can learn from them, from a physiological, psychological respect about, just like you were mentioning, Evan, stimulus response kind of things. And I think a more interesting question to me is, do plants feel? To me, that's a much more interesting question, because we know that they experience stimuli and we know that they respond to stimuli. And so are they making that response based on negative experience or positive experience, subjective experience? And how do you define that? right? But the idea... Yeah.
Right, how do you define
to have a personality almost requires that we're saying that plants are conscious and they have metacognition and all sorts of higher order things that are... Exactly. It's almost like ludicrous to even
anthropomorphization.
Totally.
Yeah, that's what it is. So the question for me is always, does this metaphor enhance our understanding of what's going on, or is it a distraction or even misconception? And I think in this case, it doesn't enhance it at all. This calling it a personality in no way enables us to think more clearly or more deeply about this phenomenon. In fact, I think it's misleading. What this for me, this is all about evolution. And the common thread here between like people and animals and plants and you know this these adaptive responses is all this is how evolution optimizes survival. Mm. And that's really the only common thread that I'm seeing here. Calling a personality, I don't think adds to our scientific understanding. I think it's a distraction.
Well, and all it really...
That's the one that the reporter ran with, and that's a perfect example of why it's a distraction.
It also really tells you more about the person interacting with the plant than the plant itself. Like if you really were interested in let's say that there was a taxonomist, 200 years ago who collected a bunch of plants and observed them every day for a year and then said, these plants are sunnier and happier plants and these plants tend to be more moody. It's like really you're telling us about you and about how you are relating to the plants. I definitely think that a question of what a plant's subjective world is like is a much more interesting and like it's a philosophical question that could open up to more, I don't know, meaningful conversation. But whether or not they have personalities is just sort of like it, like you said, Steve, it's like a distraction.
Yeah. And also, to take this to its absurd extreme, because somebody does. Remember about Dr. Emoto, who used metaphors to argue that waters have feelings and emotions and they can respond. They'll make happy water crystals or sad water crystals. It's like that's the end result of like abusing a metaphor in science that isn't actually real. And maybe that's why I'm especially annoyed by it. But all right, let's move on. All right, so I told you I was going to talk about something else relating to Newton. And I am going to talk about Galileo, who came before Newton. And in many ways, Newton was able to fulfill some of the things that Galileo could not or did not in his day. But the reason I'm talking about this, I'm kind of waiting to do this one until the time is right. Because I got an email a while ago saying from a listener who said that they heard that the history of the church trying to silence Galileo was all wrong. And in fact, Galileo was the bad actor in that whole play because he was making scientifically bad arguments. So, like, he was just violating, what basically passed for peer review at the time, and he was doing bad science.
Yeah, he was saying, like, I looked into a telescope and I saw this.
What was peer review before science was actually an established discipline?
Exactly. So hang on. So let's back up. So this is a very common misconception because, of course, it's being promoted by vested interests. So I found, for example, on creation.com. So you know it's not true, right? So they basically were saying you've heard the story of the church trying to oppress Galileo. Well, it's totally wrong. And then they say this. Galileo was foolish and arrogant in the way he argued his case. He made enemies unnecessarily and threatened the establishment's hold on the education system. Even at the time, many considered that he was the victim of politics rather than attempts to safeguard Christian doctrine. So this wasn't about the church protecting Christian doctrine. It was about, it was more of a scientific argument, and Galileo was just bad politically and bad scientifically. All of that's bullshit. Let me tell you what the real story is about Galileo. Fortunately, we have institutional memory that is continuous from that time to the present in the Catholic Church, and they're a little obsessive about keeping records. And so there we actually have transcripts from the trial of Galileo.
Transcripts.
Right?
Wow.
I don't know if you knew that.
Wow.
Now, this is not necessarily like a court stenographer word for word. This is the church's sort of cleansed version of what happened. But we also have a lot of letters from people. So there's the bottom line is there's a lot of documentation. And the thing is that even if you're looking at the official report by the church of what happened, it 100% says, yes, we were oppressing, you know, Galileo in order to protect church doctrine. I mean, like, there's no question that's what was going on. So let me talk about that for a minute. So there was actually two issues at stake here. One was, did Galileo have permission to publish the book, you know, the dialogue, where he explores this question of the geocentric versus the heliocentric system, right, universe? And remember, the dialogue was basically a conversation among three people. There was Simplicio, who was defending the geocentric universe, and yes, the name is extremely deliberate. And then there was the scientist who was very reasonably defending the heliocentric universe, and then there was the intermediary who was just asking questions, the person that they were explaining things to. And it was, Galileo deliberately framed this as a discussion to give himself plausible deniability, which gets to the second part of the trial. But the first part was just, did he have permission? So the prosecutor came to the trial armed with a letter that was essentially an edict saying you can't publish a book that promotes the Copernican, heliocentric model. But he didn't know that Galileo basically kept for years a letter from somebody with authority in the church who said that he was given permission to publish this book. And in fact, the church twice gave it its imprimatur, right? Imprimatur is a Latin phrase that literally means let it be published. And it means, yes, the church says you can publish this book. Twice they gave it the imprimatur. So it was kind of hard to argue he didn't have permission to publish the book. But, the question was what was stated in the book okay? And he had a letter saying it was okay. And they basically neutralized each other, the two letters, and so they were at an impasse. But the second part of the trial was whether or not Galileo actually believed that the sun was at the center of the solar system rather than the earth. It was about what Galileo believed in his heart, not what he said or what he wrote. If he did actually believe it, that was a much more serious crime of heresy. If he was just saying it hypothetically, then that may or may not have been okay, depending on the letters, right? So the letter was really about, is it okay to talk about it hypothetically? Galileo had evidence that said yes. The prosecutor said no. So that was the impasse. But if he really believed it, then he was screwed, right? So in the court trial, Galileo was saying, hey, listen, I'm just a conversation. I'm not saying I actually believe this. This is just, I'm putting it out there for people to discuss, which the church basically said was okay. Although they also, because of the, there's historical reasons, the Protestant Reformation, whatever, they were sort of clamping down on that whole, you could talk about things in the abstract notion. So that's why that was a little controversial. But again, it came down to, these two questions. Could Galileo publicly discuss an idea they didn't like, even in the abstract? And what did Galileo actually believe?
Oh my gosh, it's like the equal and opposite of Alex Jones.
Yeah.
You remember when that was like at the center? Like, does he actually believe what he's saying? Right.
Now, so Galileo, this was the notpology Galileo sort of came up with in order, this was sort of the compromise to get over the impasse. So this is what he says. This is like, again, this is word for word. He says, now I freely confess that it appeared to me in several places to be written in such a way that a reader, not aware of my intention, would have had reason to form the opinion that the arguments for the false side, which I intended to confute, were so stated as to be capable of convincing because of their strength rather than being easy to answer. And of course, he's talking about the Copernican side. So he's basically saying, I was just trying to refute Copernicus. But I could see that somebody might get the wrong idea if they weren't aware that was my intention, right? Now, I took an entire college course on the dialogue on that book. Wow. And there is absolutely no way you could read that book and think that Galileo was trying to refute Copernicus. I mean, it's just there's no fair reading of the dialogue would lead you to that conclusion. But this was sort of the theater compromise that they came to. And so this is what led to his house arrest rather than, you know, so do you know how? So, and by the way, the trial was being run by the Inquisition. So you might have an idea about how they determine what somebody actually believes.
They torture them.
Torture
they
them.
Torture them. Right, that's right. Yeah.
They oh, that always gets you to the truth.
Until
right?
you reveal what you so they basically.
Yeah, but you say whatever you need to for them to stop
course.
Torturing.
Well, of course, we know yeah. that. But that at the time, that's how they determined what you actually believed was they tortured you. But, you know, by this time, Galileo was old, not in great health. So they sort of, and, you know, remember the Pope was actually his friend, although he was pissed at Galileo for this whole thing. But still, they kind of, and Galileo was already famous and they didn't want to torture a famous guy. So they basically let him off the hook in terms of the torture. We could argue about their exact motivations. But they said, okay, we won't torture you. We'll just sort of accept your word that you don't really believe this. But you did kind of step over the line. So we're going to put you under house arrest. So that was kind of the compromise. You can't read the transcript of the trial and the opinion without coming away with the conclusion that the church was interested in shutting down dialogue about a concept that they thought was heresy, and they didn't want people to actually believe it because it was heresy and it threatened their authority. They say it unapologetically. You know, this is, for example, they say, therefore, lest this opinion spread further and endanger Catholic truth, it is ordered that the said Nicholas Copernicus's De Revolutionibus Orbium, whatever his title of his book, commentary on Job, are suspended until corrected. Also that the book of, and they mention another book, be completely prohibited and condemned. Right? They're saying, this threatens Catholic Church, so we're banning it. Right, that was the edict that the prosecutor brought to the trial. There's no question that's what was happening. But let me get to the second question here. Was Galileo correct in his scientific arguments? And the answer to that is yes and no. You know, Galileo wasn't completely correct because he didn't invent gravity, right? He didn't come up with Newton did that. He never came up with the actual solution to how things actually work. It took Newton to do that. So what you have to know very quickly is what the Catholic truth was. Basically, the Catholic Church endorsed Aristotelian physics. And quickly, what that was, you know, Aristotle believed that everything material, matter, in the universe had an inherent tendency to move toward the center of the earth. And so the earth was immobile at that point. And things fell to earth because they were trying to get to the center of the earth and the earth just got in the way. But that's why things fell. But you might ask, well, what about the celestial bodies? Why aren't they moving toward the earth? And Aristotle's solution was to say, because they're different and they're not matter and they are weightless, because they're weightless, they do not have a tendency to move towards the center of the earth. So they're just floating up there in the heavens. So what Galileo...
It's so arbitrary, Steve, though, that is like this is the church's position. Like, yeah. It has anything to do with religion.
Right. That's just... That was the dogma. That was it.
Yeah.
And it was just their authority because they said that's the way it was. That's the way it was. So what Galileo successfully did was disprove Aristotle. He showed... And this is where the telescope comes in, Bob, right? So one major... line of evidence was, well, let's look at the moon. It certainly looks like stuff. It's not perfect. There are craters and ridges and imperfections everywhere that are clearly obvious when you look at it with a telescope. So that blows away one major pillar of Aristotle's position. And then we could look at the moons of Jupiter and look, they're moving around Jupiter. They're not moving around the Earth. And that was sort of another pillar of evidence that he blew away. So he said, if the stuff in the heavens is the same as the earth, Aristotle doesn't work. But what does work is that everything is revolving around the sun and the earth is actually moving. So the opposition said, well, we can't feel the earth move. And he said, well, it's too subtle for you to feel, but we will be able to detect it one day that the earth is moving. And he was correct about that. They said, okay, well, if the earth is moving, why don't we see parallax with the stars? And Galileo said, because they're too far away. And he was right about that.
Pretty much right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, and when we got better and better and better measurements, it took a couple hundred years after Galileo, we were able to measure the actual parallax of the nearby stars, right? So he was right about that. But then he said, another way we know the Earth moves is because of the tides. And he was wrong about that, again, because he didn't know about gravity. So Galileo was wrong in that one line of argument, and he didn't really prove the Earth moves, but he did prove that Aristotle couldn't, his system didn't work, and he was exploring other ways of explaining how things worked. And he moved the ball forward, and then, you know, Newton picked up that ball and then took it all the way to gravity. And, you know, Newton sort of building on Galileo said, okay, well, maybe the apple falling is the same force that makes the moon go around the Earth. You know, and that's gravity. So that was sort of this brilliant insight. You know, this is obviously a massive oversimplification, but that basically paints the picture for you. Right. So this is a case in which the story of Galileo is basically true. The church prosecuted him to keep him from spreading what they considered to be heresy, even though it was just a scientific discussion. They were concerned with what Galileo actually believed in his heart, because that's even worse heresy. They were trying to shut it down through banning and through prosecution. The one Hollywood thing that's almost certainly not true, because it's apocryphal, is that, you know, after Galileo's Notpology, it's rumored that he stood up to walk back to his seat or whatever. So it was rumored that Galileo mumbled under his breath, "And yet it moves." You know, like,
oh, that's saying, right.
He had to confess the Earth doesn't move, but then he said, "And yet it moves." He never said that. That's totally that's Hollywood apocryphal. That never happened.
Right.
We have the transcripts, and it, by the way, how would we ever know if he mumbled something under his breath?
Right, no mumbled.
Yeah. So, in any case, you know, so yeah, so some, you know, untrue bits seeped in there for drama, but the core story is absolutely correct, and it's just as bad. In fact, probably worse than most people think.
And well, then Galileo, I want to see this movie.
I know. And Galileo was,
Netflix
series
or something.
The real, like a really
especially
good
movie. With the real transcripts.
Yeah. Well, you imagine putting those actual words into the mouths of actors. It would be awesome.
Oh, wow.
Because, yeah, the reality is actually more interesting than the Hollywood version, and it's actually more damning. And Galileo was mostly right. He was right as far as he went. He was wrong about a couple of details, and he didn't have he didn't know about gravity. So, but, you know, you can't, that's not why the church was against him. It wasn't because he was a jerk or because his arguments weren't sound. That's not it at all. There's no mention in the trial. There's no criticism of his scientific arguments or his logic or anything. It's all about, did you have permission? And what do you really think? That was it. Hmm. That was the trial. So,
hey, Steve.
There you go. Yep.
I know you mentioned at the beginning the kind of relationship between Galileo and Newton, which, by the way, I love the way you say Newton. I say Newton or Newton, but you say Newton.
Like Fig Newton.
Yeah, you say Newton.
Newton.
I know.
Connecticut
should swallow
the right way to say it.
That's the right way. Newton.
Newton.
But I when I was like digging around in Newton's history, I was trying to, you know, understand. We've done science or fictions about the fact that he, yes, very much was an alchemist.
Yeah.
But I didn't realize, and maybe this is well known, that basically until he died, his last job for quite a while was working at the mint. And he pushed to change the coins in England at the time over to a better standard. And he was really obsessive about prosecuting counterfeiters and sent multiple counterfeiters to the gallows.
Yes.
Wow.
Yep.
So is that well known, Bob?
I've heard that before.
Well known by me, but, you know.
I had no idea.
It is well known that you know, Newton was
He could be a bastard.
Right, yeah. And I mean, there's different ideas about, did he have a personality disorder? Was he on the spectrum? You know, what was going on with him psychologically, blah, blah, blah. But it's just fascinating. And he had apparently a really rough childhood. But this idea that, like, first of all, Newton had like a day job, you know, as he was getting older.
He did a lot of
things. And
that
he was like, you know, I think it's sort of like how Einstein was a patent clerk and Newton worked at the mint. There's just something very humanizing about that. Also, he killed people. Well, yeah. sent them to their deaths.
Right.
Yikes.
All right. Anyway, so Jay, it is Who's That Noisy Time.
Give us guys, last
do it.
Hi.
Noisy.
Newton.
Ready?
Newton.
Yep.
Newton.
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 Didn't have a Newton. Guys, last week I played this noisy. So what is this?
I think that's somebody grinding a knife with, I think, a 60-grade belt grinder.
Are you saying that, Steve?
Either that or I'm watching show far too much Forge and Fire.
Yes, that's what I knew it was that. All right, well, I mean, it's a weird noisy. It's weird, but when you find out what it is, you might smile a little bit because it's pretty cool. Okay, so James Smith.
James Smith.
He says, this cracked me up. James, he said, slowed down dental work. Specifically the suction tool and the drill polisher. Oh, my God. Oh, I thought that was funny, though. Because that you know, if you've ever had any tooth drilled, it does make that like that deep.
Oh, but it's really high pitched.
Yeah. That's why it's slowed down.
Yeah.
When it smell, you can smell your tooth dust.
Yes, I know. That's disgusting, isn't it?
But I thought James's guess was definitely like, it was good, you know, because I felt that noise in my mouth before, definitely. But you're not correct. Let's move on. Kevin Malfa. He said, hello, Jay. My son and I were listening in the car, and he wanted me to send in his guest. His name is Keenan. He is 6 years old, and this is his first Who's That Noisy guess.
Oh.
I like that he said it's his first, because he might guess some more. He said it is the sound of a cast cutter. Last year, he broke his leg on the playground right in the middle of summer, so he got to hear this noise a few times in hopes he doesn't have to hear it again, I bet. He says that breaking his leg was the worst thing ever.
Unless he goes into orthopedics.
Right. Well, he never know. We never know now that he knows what it's like.
It's better to be on the other end of the saw, Keenan.
So his son said that breaking his leg was the worst thing ever. I'm sure it was. And thanks, Jay, and everyone for all the skepticism and critical thinking you spread. So this is a cool guest. Now, though, I have heard these, I think, probably only on TV shows, right? Like, I don't think I've ever been in front. Have you been around one of these cutters, Steve?
Wait, bone saws? Yeah. Well, if you've heard it on a TV show.
No, a cast saw. A cast saw.
I've been on both ends of that saw, yes.
If you've heard it on TV, unless it was a reality show or like a documentary, you likely just heard Foley art.
Oh, anyway. I totally agree. I totally agree. Yeah, I mean, even like... You know, you ever hear this? Like when you ever hear a eagle scream, it's not an eagle; it's a hawk.
Yeah, we talked about that. The red hawk. Sorry to interject, specifically
a red-tailed hawk.
Red-tailed hawk. Yeah. Sorry to interject, but I did a whole Foley bit on Brain Games last season. And do you know what's a common sound of breaking bones? Do you know what they usually use?
Yes, they use celery.
Celery. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Crack some celery.
Foley.
Farley.
So, Steve, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Does that sound like a cast saw?
I mean, you know, superficially. It's not specifically, but you know, there's certainly elements that are similar.
Okay. All right, cool. That's good to know. All right, so that's incorrect, but definitely keep sending in those guesses because it only makes you smarter. Okay, this one is from Ben. He says, hi, guys. Ben here, French guy from Kyoto, Japan. I bet you have an interesting story, Ben, of how you found your way in Japan. I think this is an air-powered tool, probably some kind of circular grinding or drill. And he goes on to explain it. So you got one thing correct in there, the word air. So now let's move on to the closest guess I got because there was no winner. But this one's pretty close. It's a good guess. This guess is from Nicholas Underwood. He said, hey, my dude, this could very much be a thrust test rig for small UAV, which is a drone, motor propeller analysis. To be more specific, it sounds like there is a single motor running at a static speed and a second motor running at a variety of speeds. The static speed motor could be in a funnel to provide the simulated wind for the motor prop being tested to provide a more realistic experiment. So, okay. So this was a good guess because what this actually is... This noise specifically comes from a Boeing 777, and this is called a Ram Air Turbine. So the RAT, right, Ram Air Turbine, the listener Dennis wrote in that this is tested on the ground. Many jetliners have these turbines. It provides hydraulic pressure and in some cases also electric power for critical systems when engine power is lost. Okay, so What happens is that at the bottom of the jet, I think towards the front, a little propeller drops out of the fuselage, comes down. It's connected to the fuselage, but it's lowered when the plane loses power. And that little propeller spins up because the plane is moving hundreds of miles an hour, and it actually provides energy and hydraulic pressure for the airplane, right? So it's a little generator that comes down out of the bottom of an airplane when an airplane loses power, so the pilots can still fly the airplane and do some stuff in the airplane. And this thing has, he said that it saved two airplanes. One was an Air Canada Boeing 767, and the other was an Air Transit Airbus 330 that ran out of fuel. Now, I think most airplanes have these now, and I remember hearing about them before. I saw a documentary about an airplane where the pilots glided the airplane to an airport 20 miles away from where they'd lost power. And this thing happened. This thing deployed. It was the first time I saw it. And I was like, oh, my God, it's such a good idea. So that noise you heard was it spinning up. So I'll just play it again for you real quick so you can hear what's happening. So you see here the initial fan. And that's the propeller that's being spun by the air. So the guesser did a good job. All right, I have a new noisy. So nobody won this week. This week's noisy was sent in from by a listener named Katie from Scotland. What is that noise? What's making that noise?
I know it's a wee birdie.
Well, it is definitely a chirping noise, but birds are not the only things that make chirping noises.
Right.
You know, if you think you know what it is, what do, Steve? You email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Or if you heard a cool noise this week, just send it in. You never know. I might use it. You never ever know.
All right. Thanks, Jay. So, all right. We got a bunch of emails. I'm not going to read any one, but just sort of summarize what they were about. This is a response to the discussion last week about racial bias. We were talking about just facial recognition in general, but we talked about the fact that there's racial bias in facial recognition applications. And there were some positive and negative emails, but I think definitely more negative. And the theme, they all had the same theme. And that theme was that we are getting too political on the SGU, and that this is an example of getting political, you know, trying to make a political point about racial bias, and that we should stick to the science. So I'm going to talk about this in that concept in general, that I'm going to hand it over to Kara to tell us about the science of racial bias and facial recognition. The thing you have to understand is a couple of things. One is, don't assume that we are not talking about actual scientific evidence. I know we're not doing a deep dive on a topic, but we're just sort of referring to it. That doesn't mean that we are not speaking from a place of understanding what the scientific evidence says. Remember, there's an editorial filter in here. If I thought it was, you know, incorrect or not scientific, I could edit it out. That's not to say that nothing ever gets through. No off-the-cuff comments get through that aren't correct. They do, absolutely. But don't assume that we are talking from a place of bias when, in fact, we may be talking from a place of science. The other thing I want everyone to understand is that the science of racial bias is something that Kara specifically studies. And so don't assume that Kara is just being political when she says there's evidence for racial bias here. You should at least first wonder what that evidence might be. So Kara literally had to cut and paste like the same list of research to like everybody who said, there's no science here. This is all race. This is all political bias. Okay, here's all the science. Then get back to me. No one ever got back. But tell us about the science of bias and facial recognition, Kara.
Right. And this is this goes deep. So obviously we can't spend all the time we would love to spend on it. And I just want to recontextualize one more time before I dive into it, that last week when Jay was talking about his news item, there was just a quick kind of off the cuff comment about how there is racial bias. Right. Jay mentioned that. But he said, I think something sort of like, I doubt they mean it, or I'm sure that the developers meant well. And that's when I felt the need to interject. We actually, I think a good analogy for this would be when we talk in the skeptical movement about shruggies in medicine, right? That's like a common theme. Like, you know, it's not the doctors that are actively promoting the pseudoscience. Obviously, that's bad. But it's the people kind of just look the other way and go, meh, he does what he does. I do what I do. I'm not going to like, you know, I'm not going to raise a fuss when my university invites that speaker in. And I think it's a similar thing. We have to be so careful not to say, oh, they probably meant well. It's not their fault. Like, to me, that kind of a position is one that perpetuates the problem, as opposed to a position that says the evidence is clear and this is not something that we can, you know, allow to continue. So, yes, you're right. There is a political or an ideological or a, you know, moral stance that I'm taking. But that is, as you said, Steve, based on the evidence. And so the one thing I wanted to point to, which I think is probably the probably one of the more important studies that people can look into on their own, is the NIST study, which was published in 2019. This is a National Institute of Standards and Technology report that was published where they asked developers to submit a bunch of facial recognition algorithms. So 99 different developers submitted 189 algorithms from all over the globe. And they found that some algorithms were up to 100 times better at seeing white faces. And they found that on average, most of the algorithms were better at seeing white faces. And you can really dig into the statistics here. Now, I know some people wrote back and said, but why? Couldn't it just be a function of the fact that, you know, a darker pixel is harder to identify? But it's very hard for me, although there's some truth to that. But it really does remind me of turn of the century race science that we saw in psychology, where it was like, yeah, but black people do poorer on intelligence tests. And it's like, yeah, but how? Who developed the intelligence tests?
Well, yeah, so along those lines,
how did they develop them?
Yeah, because when I was looking into this also, you know, they often there are standards, like in order for a facial recognition software to meet specs, it has to reach a certain threshold of accuracy. And when they get to that threshold with Caucasian faces,
they say
stop.
It's good enough.
Yeah, yeah. They it's even though they know they're not getting there with darker skinned faces, or maybe they just don't even bother to test it, or they don't think to test it. They say, oh,
that's the point I was trying to make.
even if it's because of a technological reason, it's still kind of baked in that, well, we got it working for white people, so we're done.
Right. And the thing is, that's not kind of, that's absolutely a problem. And like you said, Steve, I think it's important for us to make the distinction that, let's say it's white developers, let's say it's black developers, you know, racism is intrinsic. We know this. It's systemic and it's intrinsic. And so it's a cultural phenomenon. It's not a personal phenomenon, although we could talk about personal racism. That's not what we're discussing here. So the idea that a developer or a programmer or a large corporation that has a group of developers wouldn't even think to standardize with black faces is not just a whoopsie doodle. That's a problem. It's an important problem. And it's a problem that's the whole point of this, that needs attention being drawn to it. Because until that conversation is part of the conversation from the beginning, that's the definition, guys, of systemic bias and systemic racism. It's the whoopsie doodles, because my own skin color means I don't have to think about that.
So just to give another example, so there are studies, for example, which show that, you know, those Purell dispensers where you put your hand underneath them?
Or like the water.
Where it's automatically detecting your presence and it activates. So they don't work as well for darker skinned people.
Right.
And so why is that? Well, because they just were never tested on darker skinned people. Or again, they got it to work for lighter skin. It works, right? So it kind of creates this. Yeah, is that such a big deal? Well, you know, it creates this reality that this world was not built for you.
Right? And that's when I mentioned this idea of what do we consider normal in an ethnocentric monoculture, and what do we consider other? And I think a lot of people who responded took that as I was making a sort of like value judgment about individual racism. But what I was saying is that culturally, we operate and have since the inception of American culture, at the very least, but most of Western culture, that there is a normal and there is an other. And it's baked into all of our systems.
Yeah, you don't even think about it.
Yeah, the people that make the decisions for the quote normal. And of course, these things are in air quotes, guys. You know that I don't actually view it this way. None of us do. But culture does, and that's a problem.
So just to give another completely different example, but just to illustrate this. So, you know, Perry was a very big guy. And, you know, he introduced me to this concept of FGF, as he called it, fat guy friendly. So he said, going through life, navigating this world as a very large person, you realize that the world is not built for you. And right. he knew, like, for example, every restaurant in driving distance of us that had chairs he could fit into, because many of them did not. And because they were built for the average or the quote unquote normal person, not for every person. It was invisible to me, right? I had no idea about it. But once I was aware of it, you realize that you're right. This world is not built for you. And, and he had to learn how to navigate it. And of course, it's the same thing with people with disabilities and ramps.
Right.
And all that.
That's why we have the ADA, you know, and we're kind of ahead of the curve here in the US, not compared to all countries, but there are definitely developed nations with really, really good infrastructure that just don't have the ramps. They don't have the elevators. They just haven't made those adaptations. And so it's like, in some respects, we really got it. And in other respects, we're just really behind. And that's probably because of the political ideology and the social forces that are at work. You know, we have a darker past when it comes to race. And it's something that we're definitely trying to reconcile and to work with. But it's hard when people aren't willing to admit that it even exists.
Right, right. And again, the final word, just as a reminder, we talk about science and logic and philosophy, but we don't talk about politics per se, but that doesn't mean we don't talk about topics that have a political angle to them. Like, we talk about teaching evolution versus creationism in public schools. That's a political question, but we talk about it because it is a scientific question with political implications.
Right.
And so that's the same thing here. We are coming from a place of trying to understand the literature and the evidence as best as possible, but of course also in a philosophical, ethical framework that we think is valid.
Steve, can I bring up another point of clarification?
Sure.
So, you know, I noticed that you didn't talk about the live stream, and I wonder if some people are confusing the content on our podcast versus what we talk about on the live stream. Because the live stream is definitely way more off the cuff, way more personal about ourselves. And we have been talking about politics on the live stream.
Well, that does not have the editorial filter that this show has. The live stream is not the SGU.
It's also right. Live.
Yeah.
Right.
Right, right. Yeah. No, in this case, it was directly coming from the show, not from the
live
stream.
It was from the show.
Oh, okay. Because I was going to let Kara know that sometimes we complain about her on the live stream. Kara, it's so cute. People in the chat are always like, where's Kara? What's up with Kara?
Yeah.
Yeah, come check us out, though. Fridays at 5 p.m., just not the day after
Eastern.
Thanksgiving.
5 p.m. Eastern.
Eastern, yes. 5 p.m. Eastern, sorry. See?
Eastern Standard
See how time. I'm excluding everybody else in the world?
All right.
Actually, it's Eastern Daylight Time now, I think.
Let's move on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 genuine and 1 fictitious. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. Now, there's a theme this week. The theme derives from the fact that we spoke about Isaac Newton and Galileo Galilei on the show this week. The theme is 17th century scientists.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, crap.
Cool.
All right. All right, here we go. 3 items about 17th century scientists. Item number 1, Lady Margaret Cavendish, a 17th century philosopher, scientist, poet, fiction writer, and playwright, anticipated many of the naturalism arguments credited to Thomas Hobbes and David Hume. Item number 2, Marcello Malpighi, an Italian physician and biologist who founded the science of microscopic anatomy, was criticized by his peers for suggesting that his discoveries would be of any use to medicine.
Oh, my God.
And item number three, Daniel Gabriel Fahrenheit, the inventor of the first precision thermometer in wide use, died at the age of 50 of mercury poisoning. All right, Bob, go first.
Let's see, Cavendish. I thought for sure that was going to go with down the banana angle,
banana?
But it didn't.
No.
You know that's why he picked this one.
So she anticipated naturalism arguments from Hobbes and Hume. Oh, man. Knowing what I know about women in science going back a ways, I got to go with that. That's got to be science. Probably, maybe. I definitely put money on that.
Okay, Bob.
Probably, maybe, got to be.
So let's see. Malpighi, Italian physician, microscopic anatomy. It's like, dude, that's useless. You're wasting your time. Of course I could see that. Damn, these are just too easy. And Fahrenheit, mercury, of course. So, yeah, I don't know what to pick. They all seem, you know, screw it. I'm going to go with Fahrenheit. That's just too damn obvious. I'll say that's fiction.
Okay, Jay?
Yeah, to cut to the short, I think I agree with Bob. I mean, the first one about Lady Margaret Cavendish, it seems so typical, right? I mean, it makes a lot of sense. So I really can't argue against it. The one about the guy's name that I can't pronounce, I could see this too because, you know, a lot of scientists were criticized for coming up with something that was either totally novel or contradicted, you know, existing thought and everything. It's very typical for scientists to fight tooth and nail for things like that. So that makes a lot of sense. And I agree with Bob. This last one just seems a little bit too on the nose about the mercury poisoning. So I'm going to go with that.
Okay, Evan.
Lady Margaret Cavendish. That one's too good to be fiction, Steve. So I think that one is science. And then, so it comes down to this other one. Right. So, you know, I guess I'm going to go with the guys about Cecil Celsius here or Melvin Kelvin. What's his name? Oh, Daniel Gabriel Fahrenheit. Yeah.
Melvin
Kelvin.
I'll go with
Melvin Kelvin. Obviously, it was his first name. So I'm with the guys. I think that one's the fiction.
All right, Kara. So, Kara, last week you were alone.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I'm not losing.
Not doing that shit again.
It's scary out there. It is scary.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like you're trying to get us with, like, the Marie Curie kind of a thing. And, like, the, you know, it's like, I worked with x-rays all the time. Or, like, people who, like, worked with some sort of, like, horribly toxic substance. And then, of course, that's what ultimately got them. But it feels way too on the nose. Maybe it's science, but I think I got to go with the guys and say it's fiction that Fahrenheit died of mercury poisoning.
Okay. So let's start. We'll take these in order since you all agree on the third one. Lady Margaret Cavendish, 17th century philosopher, scientist, poet, fiction writer, and playwright, anticipated many of the naturalism arguments credited to Thomas Hobbes and David Hume. You all think this is science, and this one is science.
Yeah, baby.
Good.
All right. Go.
She was totally cool. I am retroactively in love with her. But this is this.
You have a crush.
Totally. So, I mean, obviously it was the 17th century, so she believed a lot of things that were completely wrong. Like she thought that when one object hits another object, it transfers its motion to that object by telling that object how to move. Like it was transferring information of movement, but then the other object moved of its own accord. It's like, so she had no idea about momentum and the conservation of momentum or anything like that. So, but of course, because you know this is all pre, you know, Newton. But when it came to like the philosophy of science, she was so freaking spot on the nose. It is unbelievable, and she does not get enough credit, you know, for what she came up with. But here's my favorite thing that she said. She basically said that just because we don't know how matter thinks doesn't mean we can't know that it does think.
Ooh.
Right?
Right.
Which is an argument that I've made myself because I've had to make it because there are people who are still using that argument. Yeah. Well, we don't know exactly how the brain works, so it's magic, you know.
Yes, and so therefore,
I mean, I've had to write about this numerous times, you know, in order to make this point. It's like, oh my God, she nailed it over 300 years ago. She completely nailed it. And she gives lots of examples like, well, we don't know how magnets work at the time, right? This is in the 17th century. but we know that they do work. You know, and she goes like this long list of things that at the time they had no idea how they worked. But you know, just from a philosophical point of view, you could know that something is true without knowing why or how. She said, we know so little about why and how. Forget about it. The other thing she said, which is, again, we've had conversations on the show about that she nailed over 300 years ago. It's like, if you find yourself getting into a discussion about like this really abstract whys and hows that we'll never be able to figure out, forget about it. Focus on the practical things about how stuff actually works. Right? Haven't we had that conversation more than once on this show?
Mm-hmm.
Like just the shut up and calculate kind of idea about forget about how the world works. It's way too complicated. We're never, you know, it's, you know, we don't, we're so far away from understanding it. Let's focus on practical things we can actually figure out.
Yeah,
chip and away go at from it. There. So, you know, she was, and again, she made a lot of, you know, naturalistic philosophical comments that were just later expanded upon by David Hume and Thomas Hobbes, and they get all the credit for it. And whereas, you know, like, have you ever heard of Lady Cavendish before? But she was definitely an intellectual predecessor, and, you know, they were standing on her shoulders to some degree, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So totally cool. I was reading some of the stuff that she wrote. I was shocked at how prescient it was. And I had never heard of her until I did it.
And everyone's like, shut up, woman.
Yeah, right. Well, I'm sure that's part of why, like, David, you know, everyone knows we've quoted David Hume probably a dozen times on this show. All right, let's go to number two. Marcello Malpighi, an Italian physician and biologist who founded the science of microscopic anatomy, was criticized by his peers for suggesting that his discoveries would be of any use to medicine. You guys focused on that third bit, but remember, any part of this can be the fiction, right? It's not just focused on that. The last sentence.
Now I'm thinking, wasn't that Hook? Wasn't it Hook who was the microscope guy?
Lewick.
Van Leeuwenhoek?
Leeuwenhoek, right.
Something like that.
The Dutch.
So Malpighi was obviously not the only guy to look at stuff under
to look through a microscope.
But this one is science.
Yeah. Oh, gosh.
So there it is. Malpighi really is the father of histology, which is microscopic anatomy. I mean, he pioneered, he is to microscopy what Galileo is to telescopes. He took that technology and said, I'm going to look at little, you know, the microscopic structure of biology. And he essentially laid down the principles of histology and pathology, and you learned a tremendous amount about plants and animals, about every organ in the body. And it is true, his peers are like, how is knowing all this microscopic anatomy, glomerules in the kidney and the ducts in the liver, how is this going to help us in medicine? It's a waste of time.
Right.
And when was
now,
this?
Hand me those leeches.
17th
Do we know
century.
It was like 16th?
Yeah, Steve, but he didn't find the animacules though, right? Because right,
no, animacules.
I love that.
That's
word.
A thing, man.
I know. And they used to eat animacule crackers for the kids.
Steve, I actually had a student when I was teaching intro bio lab, and I'm sure you've come across students like this too. We were doing, the lab on the cell, and it was like, ooh, we're going to look at a plant cell, and we're going to look at an animal cell, and we're going to look at a protist. And I remember my student yelling out, exasperated, "Ugh, why do I need to know this? I don't want to be a biologist. I want to be a doctor."
Yeah. Oh my God.
Okay, now you're neither.
That
you need to know the difference between a plant and an animal cell.
Rude awakening. So, but this is even worse. This is not like individually useful. This is like science doesn't need to know this stuff in order for medicine itself to improve.
Right.
But very much like Cavendish, Malpighi was like, I don't know how this is going to pan out in the future, but it's got to be helpful to know all of this microscopic structure about how the organs are actually working at the smallest scale. I'm sure, you know, play this out into the future and this will be helpful. And of course, he was absolutely correct. We now understand disease, right, at the microscopic level. And he also said, whereas his peers were saying, this is of no use to medicine, Malpighi was saying the medicine of the time was what was of little use. And he was absolutely correct. It's not that this is useless, you're freaking useless. This is the future. And he was completely correct. Okay, all this means that Daniel Gabriel Fahrenheit, the inventor of the first precision thermometer in wide use, which of course was the mercury thermometer, died at the age of 50 of mercury poisoning, was the fiction. He did die at the age of 50, but it was just of disease, of illness. You know, he wasn't specifically mercury poisoning. He was sick. He actually died a pauper and was given a pauper's burial, despite the fact that he was an incredibly successful scientist and inventor. He invented the alcohol thermometer and then the mercury thermometer. It was the first like mass-produced precision thermometer. He obviously, you know, invented the Fahrenheit scale because he was able to, you know, to measure temperature very, very accurately, among many other things as well. Very prolific. At the end of it, he died relatively young and penniless. You know, the classic sad. Tragic story, very sad. Did not benefit from you know, the fruits of his invention, apparently. But I just made up the part about the mercury poisoning. It was a bit on the nose. But I thought they kind of all were. You know, I'm not sure where that one stood out. Yeah. They were all kind of on the nose in the same sort of way. Like, of course she was denied. Of course they thought it was stupid. Of course he died of mercury poisoning. But yeah, you guys sniffed out the one that was actually the fake. So good job, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks for leading the way, Bob.
And I went first.
All right, Evan, give us a quote.
I frequently advise my female students who are in academic positions to be patient and focus on their science first. That's how they can make the most difference. I have often said that the best thing I can do for women in science is first to do good science. Jacqueline Barton. And she has a super impressive resume. I mean, first of all, she's a professor of chemistry at California Institute of Technology. And boy, just amazing. Just read her Wikipedia page and you'll see everything that she's done in the world of chemistry. Mm-hmm. And you know, her awards and accolades are just too many to list here, but she's pretty awesome.
Yeah, but of course you have to pay attention to, again, the systemic issues in science and STEM, but that doesn't
mean, and she's,
that's not
and
a
she's
substitute
written a lot
for doing
about
the science.
That, a yeah. ton about that
oh,
as
absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely, but it's good to say, yeah, all this is important, but don't forget we have to do the actual science.
That's right.
That's always going to be at the core. All right, guys, well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure, man.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
Anytime, Steve.
The Friday after the show comes out, we will have a Friday live stream. So we'll see you guys all then.
Yeah,
I
don't
care. Not still, yesterday.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yesterday. I missed you guys yesterday.
Next Friday, there will be a live stream. All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
God bless you, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.